sang a moment ago, Jesus is Lord. That's the sentiment expressed in the book of Matthew, chapter 28, verses 18 through 20, where Jesus said, "All authority has been given to me in heaven and on earth." And he commissioned his disciples to go into all the world, to go and teach all the nations, to baptize them in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, and teaching them to observe all the things that he had commanded them. So this one, this Lord, who has all authority, has restricted us to all the things that he's commanded. Now that's not unusual, is it? If he has all authority, it is obvious that he would restrict us to what he has commanded. His authority and his lordship is reflected in the content of the message, and it is an exclusive message. But you know, people look at us and they say, "What is it necessary to be as narrow as you people are narrow? You won't wear anybody's name but Christ. Your preachers won't wear the title Reverend. You won't have any organization above the local congregation. You won't use a piano in your worship. You're just really kind of narrow-minded." And they mean by that, you're narrow-minded bigots, is what the word usually, you know, goes with narrow-minded. Well, I'll have to confess that being narrow is not all that much fun. And I don't know of any of us, perhaps, that really want to be different just for the sake of being different. There may be some. But I'll admit that being narrow is probably narrower than most people want to be. And this thing of restricting ourselves to simply what Christ has authorized is a position that is narrower than most people want to take. And there's such a stigma attached to the term narrow today that it's about scared everybody away. And you'd think almost that the term narrow is something that's contrary to the very nature of life itself, but that's not true. Actually, narrow is very much and totally in harmony with nature or with life itself. It's in harmony with reality. The broad, the all-inclusive, the indiscriminate, that's not in keeping or in harmony with reality, really. For example, nature is narrow. Any way you look at it, nature is narrow. I remember standing on the deck of the, oh, you'd call it the monument, erected above the battleship Arizona, out in Pearl Harbor in Hawaii. That monument was erected in honor of more than 1,000 men who were buried when the Arizona battleship sank there in Pearl Harbor. Over 1,000 men perished there simply because they couldn't get air. They didn't drown in the water. There were many of them that lived for days and simply ran out of oxygen. They just simply couldn't breathe. Well, that's pretty narrow. There were a lot of other gases there. There was carbon monoxide, I guess, carbon dioxide. I don't know what all was present there in that ship, but there was no oxygen. And simply because there was a lack of one gas or one element, we find these people dying. That's pretty narrow. You remember the story of the B-17 bomber, the ship called Lady Be Good, and how because of a tremendously strong tailwind, these men returning from a bombing mission in Italy returned so quickly across the Mediterranean that they could not believe their instruments when they said, or when the instruments said that here's your home port, your home base, and deciding to not believe their instruments, they went way on past their home base, flew into northern Africa and into the deserts there, and finally, out of fuel, they had to land. They made a good landing. No one died from the crash. You know what they died from? From lack of water. Now, the people on the Arizona died not from lack of water, but from lack of oxygen. These men had plenty of oxygen on the Lady Be Good, but they didn't have enough water, and they actually died. Now, there were other substances there, probably, that they could have taken into their bodies. I don't know what all. But nature is that narrow. It just simply says, if you don't have water, you can't live. If you don't have oxygen, you can't live. Incidentally, you can't jump off of any 20-story buildings today and expect to live. Nature won't let you. Well, you say, I don't see why. That's so bigoted and narrow. Yeah, it is, isn't it? And you can object all day long and then get out there at night and jump off a 20-story building and we'll come shovel you up because that's what's going to happen to you. nature is narrow. And yet, now that we've even learned to fly, ask the astronauts how long they had to study and how long NASA spent, how many years they spent trying to find out just exactly what this narrow-minded nature had in mind out in space. They know that she's exacting. They know that nature is narrow, and that they know that if they're going to survive out there, they're going to have to do just exactly like nature says, or else they've had it. They won't come back. You know, Jesus Christ also said the same thing about himself and about his religion. Jesus is narrow. Christianity is narrow. And you may object all day long about it if you want to, but it really doesn't matter. Jesus Christ said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No man comes to the Father but by me. Well, you may object to that. You may say, well, that's too narrow-minded for me. That eliminates the Muslims, the Shintoists, the Buddhists, the Taoists, and all others. Well, that may be true, but Jesus still said it. And you can either take it or leave it. You can either like it or lump it, but he says his way is narrow. He said, enter in by the narrow gate, for wide is the gate, broad is the way that leads to destruction, and many are they that enter in thereat. But he said, narrow is the gate, and straitened or difficult the way that leads to life, and those that find it are few. Everywhere you turn, you find things shouting at us that this is narrow and that life is narrow. Incidentally, this very past week, you've taken some tests, I think. You've got a few more remaining. And I don't care how loud you may shout that 2 and 2 is 5, if on that test you said that, you just missed it. These narrow-minded professors, some of them are so narrow-minded, well, it's ridiculous. They ought to fire every one of them that's like that. Oh, you can cry and bellyache and carry on all day long, and you can weep, but it just doesn't do much good. There are many wrong answers, but you know, there's usually just one right one. Life is narrow. Jesus is narrow. Nature is narrow. Everything about reality says that, you know, after all, life is kind of narrow. Jesus Christ said in Matthew the 7th chapter, verses 24 and 21 through 24 and 25 there, that not everyone that says to me, Lord, Lord, shall enter the kingdom of heaven. That's 21, 22, and 23. Not everyone that says to me, Lord, Lord, shall enter the kingdom of heaven, but he that does the will of my Father who is in heaven. So here he narrows it down to doing the will of the Father. This was at the beginning of his ministry. At the end of his ministry, he says the same thing when he said, teach them to observe all the things that I have commanded you. So at the beginning of his ministry, he said, this is the way to get into the kingdom. Do the will of my Father. At the end of his ministry, having taught them the will of the Father, he says, this is the way to get into the kingdom. Observe all the things that I have commanded you, and lo, I'm with you always, even to the ends of the earth. So we find that we're then restrained, or we're confined into this thing of obeying the will of God. Are you going to obey God, or are you going to disobey him? And is it necessary to be so narrow? And what standard do we have to give us some kind of an indication as to what God wants of us? You know, we're all Gentiles. We can sign a kind of whine and say, well, what has he given us as an indication? How am I going to know what he expects of me? I'm not a Jew. I never have been his people before. How am I going to know what he wants of me? Well, you know, he hasn't left himself without witness there either. In Romans, the 15th chapter and verse 4, Paul says, the things that were written aforetime were written for our learning, that we through patience and comfort of the Scriptures might have hope. Now, what Paul referred to there was this body of 39 books in the Old Testament Scriptures. He said these things were written for our learning, us Gentiles. And in particular, he says to the Corinthians in chapter 10 of 1 Corinthians, he talks about those of us upon whom the ends of the ages are come. Those of us who are Johnny-come-latelys. We can profit from those who came earlier, he says. In 1 Corinthians, the 10th chapter and verse 6, after citing all the sins of the Jewish people there on that particular occasion of their coming up out of Egypt, he makes this statement, these things happen as warnings for us. That's what he says in verse 6. In verse 11 of that 10th chapter, he says, these things happened as warnings, I think he said, to them, and they were written down for our admonition upon whom the ends of the ages are come. In other words, the things that happened to the people who lived in former days, they have a message, and that message is simply to be transmitted to you and me so that we might be something more than just a dog. You know, I doubt that a dog ever profited from any record that it was ever entered into an annal of history. I doubt that there's any Great Dane that ever became greater because of something that happened 5,000 or 4,000 years ago to some other person back there in other times. They're just not like that, but people are. You're supposed to be profited by things that happened before. And he gives you this simple warning. He just simply says in Romans 15 and 4, And in 1 Corinthians, the 10th chapter, verses 6 and 11, he says, these things happened to them by way of example, and they were written down for our admonition, upon whom the ends of the ages are come. Did you ever wonder why the Old Testament was written? He says the things that happened back there happened as warnings against those, or warnings to those very people. In other words, they'd see what happened and they'd be taken, you know, kind of taken back by it. They'd kind of tighten up their belt and pull up their boots and they'd start acting better. But he said they were written down not for them. He says these things were written down for you. Now I want to ask you a question. Are you wise enough to profit from what's happened in history? Is the church wise enough to profit from what's happened in history? Not only Old Testament history, but primarily Old Testament history today. I want to show you some things today. We're given an opportunity to view a signpost. Have you ever been out somewhere, you know, lost as a coot, not knowing where on earth you were going? And just driving more or less in circles, and finally you see a sign way down the road. You take off down to see that sign. It's the only one you've seen all day long. Sure enough, it says somewhere 15 miles to the right. You know where you are then. Are you wise enough to do that with the Bible? The Old Testament, Paul says, is our guidepost, so that we might not sin like they sin. These things are our warnings, that we might not sin like they sin. These things were written down for our learning, or our admonition. We, us people today, upon whom the ends of the ages are come. The church today needs to listen to those signposts. You need to, as a young person, and as an older person, you need to listen to these signposts in the Old Testament. Let me give you some of them. And I think these things are so, they're so current. They're so, they're so relevant to our needs today. Because we are a people living, as Paul says, in these last days. We upon whom the ends of the ages have come. You know, we're awfully prone to look with disdain upon authority. We're awfully prone to dismiss and to disclaim any responsibility for wrong. We're awfully prone to come up with some things that are extenuating circumstances and to declare that these things really justify our disobedience. And we find ourselves then disclaiming authority. We find ourselves disclaiming any responsibility. We find ourselves conjuring up all these things of more or less extenuating circumstances. And we say, well, this justifies what I did. I really wasn't guilty at all. These things in the Old Testament, then, Paul says, were written for your learning, that you might keep your mouth shut, that you might not offer these excuses. Let me give you some and show you how prevalent and how current these things are really for us today. Let's go back, first of all, to Adam and Eve, and look, and notice their disobedience. I'm not going to be able, by time, to give you the details of all these events. I think you know them. And I'm going to take the chance of taking the chance. I'm going to take the chance of assuming that you understand and know the background and know pretty well the story. And I'm going to draw some conclusions for us this morning that I think will help you and will help me in our living of our Christian life. Go back to Adam and Eve just very briefly. Eve had been commanded, as Adam had, don't touch the fruit. You can eat of every tree in the garden, but the one in the center of the garden, don't touch it. Don't eat it, because in the day that you eat thereof or touch it, you're going to die. She understood it. Adam understood it. Satan came and said, Eve, is there any tree here that you can't eat of? She said, yeah, that one right over yonder. Can't eat of that one. And she said, well, why? Because God said not to. Or she said, in the day we eat of it, we're going to die. He said, oh, you won't die. And then he began to explain away what God had said. And she was deceived, and she ate it. She then gave the fruit to Adam, and he ate it. And they both, having eaten the fruit and having sinned against God, having simply contradicted and disobeyed a direct command, you know how they then explained their disobedience? By rationalization. And I cannot help but, this was the way they explained it. They explained their disobedience by rationalization. But I cannot help but believe that it was rationalization that led them into the disobedience to begin with. When Adam was confronted with this problem, he said, well, everybody else was doing it. That's what he said. He said, the woman you gave me was eating it, and she gave it to me, and I ate it. And essentially, he was saying there, everybody else is doing it. Have you ever said that about doing something? Well, everybody else is doing it. Adam was the only man in history that ever told the truth when he said that. He was a teenager about right now. That's right. And every teenager since then has used that same argument. Everybody else is doing it. And Adam's the only one out of all the millions that have ever lived that ever told the truth about it. Everybody else in the world was eating it, but that didn't make it right. Young people, it doesn't matter how many people are doing wrong, that doesn't make it right. And it doesn't matter how many people are doing or how few people are doing right, that never makes it wrong. Wrong is wrong and right's right. And God had just simply said, don't touch it. And I don't care how many people are doing it, Adam. You're not supposed to do it. God said, don't do it. When Eve was confronted with it, what have you done? She said, the devil made me do it. That's what she said. That Flip Wilson line was not original with Flip. It was original with Eve. She said, the devil made me do it. In verse 13 of chapter 3, she said, Satan deceived me and I ate it. I'll tell you what, people have been saying that ever since. It really wasn't my responsibility. I'm not responsible for it. It really wasn't my thing. Somebody else did it. They deceived me, and then I'm the one that had to bear the responsibility, the brunt of it. No, God said, that's not good enough. God told Adam, Adam, doesn't make a difference how many other people are doing it. You're guilty. He told Eve, Eve, doesn't make a difference whether the devil did tempt you to do it. I told you not to do it, and I'm expecting you to do what I say. And he punished them and put them out of the garden, and then erected this angel or this cherubim or whatever it was, this angelic figure to say to them, you can't come back in. You've had it. Well, these people rationalize themselves into sin. But there's a second example, and that's Lot's wife. You might say Lot's wife sinned and disobeyed God under emotional pressure. You remember when Sodom and Gomorrah were destroyed? God had already made an arrangement, an agreement with Abraham that he'd not destroy the city if he could find in there 10 people who were righteous, but that failed. He then finally took Lot and his wife and their two daughters, those four, no more. He couldn't get any more to come out. But he said, I'm going to wait till you get down to the city of Zoar, and then I'm going to have to destroy the city. He said, I don't want you to look back, and I don't want you to stop anywhere in the valley, but go. The text says that Lot had already gotten to Zoar, evidently. Mrs. Lot was back a good ways, it says, behind him, and she turned around and looked, and God turned her into a pillar of salt. Whether that was done naturally by the explosion that took place there in that desert, I don't know. Or whether it was done by God's own hand in another way, I can't say. But I do know that this woman was actually turned into a pillar of salt, a crustacean of salt, somehow or another accumulated around her. She died because of that terrible fire, and God brought this judgment upon her. You say, that's awfully exact, and that's awfully narrow, Lord. This woman's friends were back there. She was under emotional pressure. This woman's sons-in-laws were back there. Two of them were. They hadn't come out. This woman's house was back there, and all of her possessions. And you know how dear possessions become to a woman. These things make her feel, you know, and all the things that she's done to her house, all that was back there in Sodom. You just keep on wailing and crying and saying how narrow-minded God is, and you may wish really to play this thing down. You may just kind of close it up, you know, and when people want to talk about Lot's wife, you may say, oh, well, that just really is not the way. God's not like that. Oh, yes, he is. Jesus Christ said, don't play down Lot's wife, play her up. In Luke 17, at about verse 37, he said, remember Lot's wife. Well, why on earth would he say that? Because he doesn't want you to forget Lot's wife. He wants you to understand what happened to Lot's wife so that it might not happen to you. Emotional pressure notwithstanding, God expects you to do what he says. That's all he's saying. Are you getting the message? Look again. Look at Nadab and Abihu. These two sons of Aaron were priests, and they'd been commissioned by God to burn incense in the tabernacle area. They came into the area and were swinging their censer. They had put a fire in it. They had put incense upon it. They were swinging it before the Lord. God killed them. You know what the only problem was? Very small one. They had used some fire that he had not commanded them to use. They had taken fire that was called strange fire. In other words, it was foreign to what God had authorized them to use. He had authorized them to use the fire from off the altar. Well, great. Fire's fire. What difference does it make? Well, just this one difference. God said, use this. He didn't say, use that. Well, that's the most narrow-minded, bigoted thing I've ever heard of. It is, in a way. And yet, if God's going to be God, he has the right to be like that. Are you willing to let him be like that? Well, I'll tell you one thing. God said to Aaron, don't you let the hair hang down off your head. Don't you tear your clothes. You take those boys out of here and bury them. Don't sniff. Don't play like you're crying. Don't do anything. You just be as straight-laced and as straight-faced. Bury those boys and let it be known that I'm going to be made holy before this congregation or else. He wouldn't even let them mourn over their own sons. And his uncle, Lot, Aaron's uncle, couldn't even mourn. And the other men there in the court, he said, don't any of you mourn. I mean what I say. I mean for you to do what I say. Do you know what their disobedience was probably could be laid to? Drunkenness. I think these men were drunk. In verse 8 of that 10th chapter of Leviticus, immediately after he had sent these people out to bury those boys, listen to what he says there about the drinking of strong drink. And do not go out from the door of the tent meeting, that's verse 7, lest you die, for the anointing of all of the Lord is upon you. And they did according to the word of Moses. And the next verse says, and the Lord spoke to Aaron, saying, Drink no wine nor strong drink, you nor your sons with you, when you go into the tent of meeting, lest you die. It shall be a statute forever throughout your generations. You are to distinguish between the holy and the common, and between the unclean and the clean. And you are to teach the people of Israel all the statutes which the Lord has spoken to them by Moses. I think these boys were drunk when they went in there. Well, good night. Then that means that they weren't responsible. Not in God's eyes, it doesn't. But they were drunk. That's right. They were guilty of two sins, drunkenness and burning strange incense on strange fire. And yet today, you know what people do when they talk about somebody killing somebody or doing something else to somebody, raping somebody or doing something? Oh, they said that he really wasn't that, except he was drunk. Listen, young people, drunkenness explains the majority of crimes that are committed today, but drunkenness doesn't excuse a single one of them. It explains the crime, but it doesn't excuse it. And in God's eyes, these men were guilty of two things, not just one. But again, look at Uzzah. You know who Uzzah and Ahio were? They were two boys, the son of Abinadab, in whose house the ark of God had been placed after the Philistines had conquered it. The ark had been brought to the house of this man, Abinadab, and Uzzah and Ahio were his boys. I guess they were teenage boys. The time came that David was going to go on down to Abinadab's house and get the ark and bring it on up. They got a new cart and put the sacred ark of God on this new cart. Ahio was up in the front of the cart. Uzzah was back in the back. And they were carrying this cart along, this sacred thing. They were more or less serving as escorts, you see. Escorts of this sacred thing to the city of Jerusalem from this little hometown of Abinadab's house. So they were on their way, and they came to the threshing floor of Nacon. And the wheel, something happened to the wheel of the cart, and it caused this sacred thing to tip, and here it came toward Uzzah, and he had to make a decision. And in his extremity, and at the very point when he had to make a decision, this man, knowing full well that God had said to them, don't touch it, lest you die. That was the commandment he had given them. Do not touch it. That had always been the commandment regarding the holy thing of God. But here this thing came at him, and more or less probably wanting to do the loving thing, and wanting probably to do what was in the best interest of the ark. He didn't want to see all those things spread out all over the ground. And this thing being thrust upon him, this man put his hands up and stayed the ark, more or less just doing what comes naturally. And yet God killed him. You know how this man was led to sin? Through accepting the philosophy of situation ethics. If this isn't an example of situation ethics, I don't know where you'd find it. Here was a situation that seems to me, in my way of thinking, and in David's way of thinking, here's a situation that would have merited going contrary to what God said. In fact, David, it says, became angry. Whenever he saw this man die beside that ark, it says David was angry because God had smitten this man and he was dying. He was dead. Situation ethics made this boy do something that he knew full well God had said, don't you do. I want to make the application. I want to put it in a different, just a wee bit different light. Here these two teenage boys were, and they had a new cart. That's what he calls it, a new cart. Ahio was driving. It says that both of them were driving, but Ahio was up front, it says. Uzzah was in the back seat. And they were serving more or less as chauffeurs or as someone to, chauffeurs, or what did I say a minute ago? They were serving as escorts. They were escorting this holy thing from this house up to Jerusalem. And Uzzah was there on the back seat here with him. He had this holy thing, this sacred thing there on the back seat with him. And lo and behold, they got over there on 4th Street, and they had a flat tire. Something happened to the wheel. When they got down to the Nacon's threshing floor, they had a flat tire. And here came this sacred thing at this boy. What was he going to do about it? Have you ever been on the back seat of a new cart with a sacred thing beside you? And you have a flat tire? And here comes this sacred thing at you? What are you going to do about it? Well, this man was faced with that decision. God had already said, don't touch it. Leave it sacred. It's to be sacred and it's to be separated and holy. You're not to touch it. Are you going to do the loving thing? You know, the loving thing on the back seat of a car doesn't always appear to be what's right. It'll deceive you. Are you going to do what comes naturally? That's all this boy did. He thought he was doing the loving thing. He thought he was doing what came naturally. And I'll tell you what, there have been many a boy on the back seat serving as a chauffeur or serving as someone to take a sacred thing somewhere else and had a flat tire. And this sacred thing come at them, they don't know how to handle it. this boy sinned because of situation ethics. God has simply said, don't touch it. And to us today, you know what he says to us? Keep it sacred. Keep it holy. Keep it set apart. Keep it for marriage. And I think perhaps you can draw your own conclusion if I haven't already drawn it for you. There's another man found in 1 Kings, the 13th chapter. He was a prophet of God from Judah. He was on his way up. God had sent him up to the city of Bethel to curse the altar there. Jeroboam had created an altar there and had built it, had created a new religion. 10 of the tribes went with him. He built this altar in order to keep the people from going back into Jerusalem to worship. The man went up there with this instruction from God. Go up there and curse the altar. Don't eat anything. Don't drink anything. And go back home a different way. He went up, cursed the altar. The king said, come to my house. Let me give you a reward. He said, if you were to give me your whole house, I wouldn't come back with you. Because God said, don't eat anything. Don't drink anything. And go back a different way. And he turned around and walked off. But there was an old false prophet who had been living there in Bethel. His sons went home and said, Daddy, you know what happened down there at the altar today? And they told him. He said, where did he go? He said, saddle me my ass. And he got on this mule and he took off after the boy. Found him sitting under an oak tree. And he said, are you the prophet of God from Judah? He said, yes. He said, well, come on home and eat something before you go on. He said, I can't do it. God has said to me not to eat anything, not to drink anything, and to go home a different way. He quoted these times what the Lord had said to him, and he understood it perfectly. This man, though, said, oh, I also am a prophet of God. And God has told me in a vision that you're to come home with me. Well, he was tired, he was thirsty, and he was hungry. So he just got up and went home with the man, depending on this man's truthfulness. But the scripture says that he lied to him. This man was led to disobedience because he failed to check his sources. He failed to check the source of the revelation. He didn't do like John says, try the spirits, because there are a lot of false prophets going out into the world today. And he went home, and while he was eating, while he was at the table, this voice from God said, you're not going to get home. You're going to be killed on the way home. And he was. You know his problem? He had a very clearly defined revelation from God. Don't eat anything, don't drink anything, and go home a different way than that by which you came. He failed to take that that was clearly defined, and in preference, he took something that he could not define, something that somebody else had said, and it was a lying prophet that said it, and the man lost his life because of it. Oh, you know, you look at these things, you say, well, that's the narrowest God I've ever seen. Well, not really. He's given you a way to obey him. He's told you clearly what he wants of you. And you ask this question, is it necessary to be so narrow as we are today? Well, it's not very pleasant sometimes, but I'm convinced that it's necessary. And if you don't believe it, look at Adam and Eve. Look at Lot's wife and remember Lot's wife. Look at Nadab and Abihu. Look at Uzzah. Look at the prophet from Judah. And if you can draw any other conclusion, and these aren't exceptions, these are just outstanding examples. You can find them by the hundreds and the thousands in the Old Testament, examples of the same kind of disobedience. And if you can draw any other conclusion from examining these things that Paul says were written for our learning so that we might not sin as they sin, then we're reading two different books. I don't understand. Words don't mean anything if these things don't stand as soldiers saying, God expects you to obey him, and he expects you to obey him just exactly like he said, do it. I don't know what it means if it doesn't mean that. Is it necessary for you to be so narrow? And when you go out of here, you know, people say, yeah, you're the people that don't believe in an instrument of music. Don't you blush. Don't you let your hair hang down. Don't you rend your clothes. Just say, this is what the Lord has commanded. I'm doing what he said, and I won't go further. It is necessary to be narrow, and I don't know whether you're willing to take that narrow stand or not, but if you are willing to stand with Christ, you'll take a narrow stand, because he simply said, my way is narrow, and no man can come to the Father but by me. And not everyone that says, Lord, Lord, will enter the kingdom, but he that does the will of my Father who is in heaven. I wonder if you want to become a Christian today. It means becoming a narrow person, but only as narrow as God's narrow, and only as narrow as the teachings of Christ are narrow. You needn't get any narrower than that. And there's plenty of room in there for you if you'll just simply accept him as your Lord and let him determine the bounds and the limits. That's what it's all about. And that's what we're asking that you do today. That's why we're not going to sprinkle you when you come forward. We'll immerse you. You know why? Because God commanded that. That's why we're not going to take little babies. We're going to take those of you who are adults who come saying, I'm sorry for my sins. Because that's what God commanded. And after all, what other authority do you have for doing anything else? None. Do you want to do that today? Will you conform to his wishes today while we stand and sing?